Miss Tay show will be on Case 66 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 66 is entitled Gangto Laughed Loudly. Engo's introduction. Adapting himself adroitly to circumstances, displaying the spirit to capture a tiger, attacking now from the front, now from the flank, planning to seize the rebel, combining light and dark, holding fast and letting go, dealing with deadly serpents. This is the master's task. Main subject, Gangto asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From the western capital." Gangto said, "After the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword?" The monk said, "Yes, I got it." Gangto stretched out his neck before the monk and let forth a great yell. The monk said, "Your head has fallen." Gangto laughed loudly. Later, the monk visited Seppo, who asked, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Gangto." Seppo said, "What did he say to you?" The monk recounted the story. Seppo gave him 30 blows with the stick and drove him out. Secho's verse. Since the rebel was suppressed, the sacred sword has been restored. Why the laughter? The master knows. Too small a reward, the 30 blows. One gains, one loses. Thank you so much for coming to practice today. Thank you. So this koan is about a very famous Zen teacher named Seppo, and his friend was named Gangto. Basically, a monk has come to Gangto's temple. And Gangto says, "Where are you from?" And the monk said, "I'm from the western capital." Gangto said, "After the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword?" So, when people think about times past, when they think about, say, Zen in China during the Tang Dynasty, you know, they think of it as a wonderful, wonderful period of history. And, you know, they think of maybe monasteries as these beautiful, peaceful places. You know, if you go to, say, Japan and you go to Kyoto, Kyoto is full of these beautiful, beautiful Japanese monasteries and temples, and they're national monuments, so they're kept up to a very high level of maintenance. You know, they're beautifully maintained, and nothing is allowed to get run down, or there's no dirt or no junk around the temples. They're like museums. And if you go there in the spring and you look at, like, the cherry blossoms, or you look at the koi in the ponds, you know, you get this, you feel very relaxed, you feel very happy, and you get the idea that, you know, this is another world. This is another world, you know, separate from our own world. It's a place of tranquility and beauty, you know. And then maybe you go into one of the temples and you see the monks meditating, and that's the conclusion you might draw. There's definitely truth to that, you know. So my feeling is that the world is a very crazy place, you know. And you don't have to look very far to see how crazy it is. You know, normally we trust in the basic rationality of the system, you know. So we have elections every 4 years. We have a Congress. We have a Senate. We have a Supreme Court. You know, we have universities. We have governor of the state of New Jersey. We have a lieutenant governor. You know, we trust in the rationality of the system. We assume basically that the system is sound and it's good and so on. And then, you know, sometimes you wake up and you can't believe what's happening. You know, you realize that the system is, you know, deeply screwed up. And that's a shock, right? And, you know, we're really still living a very protected life here in our country at this time. You know, if we're a poor person, dependent on certain kinds of federal aid, you know, the next couple of years are going to be really hard, could be really terrible, you know. So definitely this life is going to get harder for a lot of people, or probably going to get harder for a lot of people. But nevertheless, you know, it's been a while since we've had a civil war, you know, and real civil chaos, you know. But those things happen, and it definitely happened in China during the Tang Dynasty. During the Tang Dynasty, which was this brilliant, flourishing period in Chinese culture. You know, the Tang Dynasty in Chinese culture was like the Renaissance in European culture. It was this time of just incredible arts and creativity, commerce, architecture, ceramics. You know, if you study Chinese ceramics, the most beautiful ceramics are made during the Tang Dynasty. And literature, poetry, you know, the great poets of the Tang, just on and on, painting, you know, just this wonderful. And then, you know, as this was all flourishing, things started to come apart. And they had a revolution or a rebellion in China, you could say like a revolution. It absolutely tore the country apart. In fact, you know, some scholars say that like a quarter of the people in China died. Really, it's like unbelievable. They do, when they study the records, they find an area that had maybe, you know, like 100,000 people in it, and then they come back and there's 20,000, you know. And, you know, so the rebellion was very disruptive for Chinese society. And there were persecutions of Buddhism. Couple times all the monasteries were closed and all the monks and the nuns had to leave. Temples were set on fire. So, you know, basically this story is pointing to some of those shadows, right? I mean, yes, you know, if you go to a temple Hanshansa in Suzhou, beautiful place, right? You know, if you go to Daitokuji in Kyoto, beautiful, beautiful. You don't see the element, the shadows, you know? It's easy to forget that all of this clarity and compassion and awakened intelligence grew out of all of this chaos. You know, grew out of all of this chaos. You know, so it's possible to form the image of say Zen practice or Buddhism or Chinese Zen as this period of tranquility, but you know, actually a great deal of instability all the time. You know, so in some ways, this koan is all about how we cope with instability, how we deal with that instability. So you know, basically, this is funny, but it's referring to events that were really serious. Lots of people got their heads chopped off. So Ganto asked a monk who has just come to his temple, "Where are you from?" And that's kind of a special question. It means, where are you coming from? You know, what temple are you coming from, or what region are you coming from? But it's also a Zen question. If a Zen teacher, if you go to a Zen temple or you go to a Zen center somewhere, and the teacher, and you're in Dokusan, and the teacher says, "Where are you from?" It's not necessarily an innocent question. It's really asking you about your state of mind. It's really saying, what is your baseline consciousness? See, what is your baseline consciousness? So where are you from is a loaded question. Ganto asked a monk, "Where are you from?" And the monk said, "I'm from the Western capital." So that's significant, you see, because that's a part of the area that was involved in this very terrible rebellion. And Ganto said, "After the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword?" The monk said, "Yes, I got it." Ganto stretched out his neck, you know, making a long neck, and then he takes his hand, just as we would, before the monk, and he let forth a great yell. So he sort of makes a chopping gesture, like to his neck. The monk said, "Your head has fallen." Ganto laughed loudly. So, you know, this is a reference to, events that were, you know, kind of scary and kind of disruptive. So, you know, we live in times that are scary and disruptive too, you know. They aren't as scary and disruptive as what happened in China in the Tang Dynasty when lots of people died. But, you know, definitely times are very destabilizing, right? So, you know, I think you made a really good decision today to come to sit. You know, I have lots of friends who are internet addicts, you know, and I myself am an internet addict in some ways. So, you know, like last night when we were doing the sit, when I was preparing this room for meditation, I have to, put the mats out and the cushions and set up the altar. And the director of this facility who works with me, his name is George, he's a very nice man, came in and he said, "Can I give you a hand?" You know, he usually waits until everything is done and then he comes in and says, "Can I give you a hand?" So when all the tables are up and everything's done, he says, "Hey, can I give you a hand?" It's like, no, it's all fine, all good, you know. Maybe he stands there and waits until I get everything ready. I'm just kidding. But he came in, and I think what he really wants is to talk about politics. He's really not asking if the room is ready. And he follows politics very closely. And he was very... interested in Donald Trump's latest adventures, right? So he said, "Did you hear the latest?" You know, and it's like, well, I haven't looked at my computer, I haven't looked at the news for 3 hours, so I probably haven't heard the latest. And he said, "Oh my God, you know, he didn't shake Angela Merkel's hand, you know." And so we went on and on about that. I have other friends, and I myself read Politico, I read Huffington Post, I read Salon, it's possible as you read that stuff to just get so steamed up, right? You read this article, then you read, and it's outrageous, this is outrageous, you know. And indeed, it is outrageous. You know, Sometimes I feel like I'm reading a comic book, right, where the Joker has taken over Gotham, and he has all these villains now who are going to run the city government, right? So the Penguin is running the Parks Department, and it's like that, right? I mean, apparently the guy who runs the EPA wants to abolish the EPA. This second in command now is a guy who's from the coal industry. It's like, oh my, I can't believe this, right? And there really will be consequences, they're going to eliminate the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts, and so on and so on. So, lots of my friends are involved with the arts and the humanities, so their emails are going around and people are meeting and they're very upset and they're talking and what can we do, and all of that's very good. All of that's really important and very good, But it's possible to really lose your balance. It's possible to lose your perspective, right? And if you get too upset, if you're, lots of people I know, they get to the point where they're sort of like agitated or upset all the time. And they feel they owe it to humanity to be upset all the time, right? It's like they feel powerless. And so because they feel powerless, they feel they can at least contribute their unhappiness, see? And that's actually not a selfish gesture at all. They feel they owe it to everybody to be upset about all this, right? There's definitely the case that if you get to that place and you stay in that place too long, you're going to get depressed. You're going to become paralyzed. There is such a thing as burnout. So when Donald Trump passed his first anti-immigrant legislation, people went ballistic, and they went to the airports, and they disrupted the flow of air traffic, and lawyers were standing in airplane lines, giving their cards to people who weren't going to be admitted to the United States, and the lawsuits were lining up, and so on. Now, then Trump has issued a slightly revised order, and the airports are moving as usual. There's no lawyers in the airport, and so on. So, people reach a point where they just can't respond to a daily emergency, right? They have to do their job. They have to make a living. And you people get, burned out. You think, I'm just going to close down. I'm going to stop. Or they become emotionally distressed. People apparently, I was reading in the paper, psychotherapists see a big leap in their business, during the Trump era. And lots of people are being prescribed medications for anxiety disorders and depression. Those are spiking, It's all quite understandable, right? So you don't owe it to the world to make yourself miserable. That's not your moral obligation. In fact, if you can find in yourself a place of calm and compassion, you will be able to deal much more effectively with the challenges of your life, it's really a kind of like an inner battle for you not to allow these events to destabilize you too much. And it might not be these events. It might be other events also, It's definitely the case that you can be so caught up in what is happening to you that you're no longer able to respond in a creative way. And then our behavior becomes compulsive and fear-driven, right? And almost all the decisions we make in our lives, when they are motivated by fear, are usually bad decisions, actually. you know, generally speaking, fearful decisions are not good decisions. You know, the Indian teacher Jiddu Krishnamurti actually said, you know, fear kills the mind. I love that saying. You know, fearfulness makes you less intelligent. Yes, anxiety makes you less intelligent. You can't look at things if you're rattled, if you're anxious and fearful. You can't calm down enough to deal with your situation. And when people become fearful, they close down everything. It's like your eyes become less observant. Your mind takes in less information. When you're operating in that mode, you're really not operating very effectively. And people make all kinds of desperate decisions trying to protect themselves that they later regret. So, you know, some of Zen training is being in this very beautiful and serene place. But a more important aspect of Zen training is being able to be in that place in the middle of disorder and chaos, right? Understanding that is where you should be when things are falling apart. You don't owe it to mankind to be on edge all the time, or to be anxious all the time, or to be miserable all the time. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be current political events. You know, when people we love are suffering, you know, we need to be available to them. But we don't have to be, this is going to sound a little strange, but we don't have to be in suffering with them. And this is almost like a shocking thing to say. You know, when my brother was dying of cancer, I was very sad after he died, you know. And he was suffering a lot for a couple years. But, you know, I also realized that it wouldn't do much good for him if every time I saw him I started crying, you know. I had to find a place in myself where there was like lightness and spaciousness. And you know, I think my brother really appreciated my ability to be there with him in that state. You know, he was in a lot of pain, right? He didn't really need for me to come in and be in pain with him. He needed a way out of his pain, right? You know, so the best thing I could do for my brother, believe it or not, and this is going to sound a little shocking, was to be happy in his presence. You know, and actually he said, this means so much to me. For me to be happy. He understood I wasn't happy because he was dying of cancer. I was happy and I could bring my happiness to him. And it was a big relief. It's a big relief. You know, people who are quite sick don't want to be necessarily... Everybody wants to be loved and everybody wants to be missed when they're dying. But people who are sick and are suffering don't necessarily want to be around people who are also suffering. They want to be reminded that happiness is a possibility in this world. They want to be shown something else, right? You know, so I think I was able to be very helpful to my brother by being happy and cheerful when he was so sick. And he said that. He said, it means so much to me. And he didn't say it quite in these terms, but to be reminded that this is a possibility in the world, right? You know, so you can be more helpful to people if you aren't overwhelmed by the suffering of the world. You don't owe it to them to share in that suffering. On the contrary, They're looking for a way out too, right? So practicing the great way, practicing Zen, is about how learning how to find in yourself this imperturbable calm, which is really there, I swear to you. You know, if you haven't found it already, it's there. You know, you can be in absolute burning up with anxiety, and you can sit down on the cushion, and if you've trained yourself through many years of training, and if you've been sitting with diligence, you know, you suddenly reach a place where all of that anxiety goes away and you're absolutely serene. And you can do it every time if you practice. And this is really precious. It's really precious to be able to do that, right? You can't be helpful to others. You can't be helpful to yourself if you're on the edge of like profound emotional distress. You need to be able to get to that place and look at the situation from there. You know, and when we sit down on the cushion, you know, one of the things that first happens to people who meditate regularly is you learn how to have a deep relaxation response, which most people don't have all day long. You know, if you come in, if you meditate every day for, say, half an hour or something like that, after about 15 or 20 minutes, you're going to have if you do it regularly, you will have a deep relaxation response, and you'll feel your scalp loosening up, all the tension in your head or in your shoulders will loosen up, and you'll feel better. And then, you know, if you continue to sit, you will eventually get to this place, we say samadhi is how we describe it in Zen. But it's this very deep, grounded place. It's really this, we would say, the samadhi of being present with the moment. So in Buddhism, the term for being present in the moment is tat-atta. So when we talk about samadhi in Zen, we're really talking about a number of different things. One of them is the samadhi of emptiness, shunyata, which we call mu. But another is the samadhi of tat-atta, being 100% present with what is happening, see? So when you're in deep samadhi, one of the things that happens, when you're in the moment, like 90%, your anxiety goes away, your projections stop, and you're in this serene place, right? And now your relationship to everything around you has changed. You know, you've probably noticed that when you're fearful, it's very difficult to hear others or to be helpful to others. You're too afraid. But when you can enter that place, that imperturbable calm, suddenly you find this like generosity in yourself, right? You're not kicking with your arms and your legs, thrashing with your arms and your legs, trying to stay afloat. Suddenly you're calmly on the surface of the water, and you can be helpful to other people, right? You know, so if you practice Zen, you get the benefit of being able to enter a deep relaxation state eventually, but you'll also be able ultimately to reach this imperturbable calm, you know, the deep, deep samadhi. And last night, somebody came up to me and said, I've never had an experience like that. And she described it. And it was a very, very deep state of samadhi. She said like she felt like everything was flattening out. It doesn't make much sense unless you're in that state of concentration. But she has been through a very difficult period of serious illness and surgeries and so on, and has been coming back to sit after that. And she's just found this wonderful place in herself. You know, so you know, learning how to enter that place is really important for dealing with life. And, you know, once you can enter that place with regularity, you realize that living without that is really kind of crazy, right? It's really kind of crazy. You know, I do a lot of meditation, and I've talked about this before, but You know, if I say to somebody casually who doesn't meditate, I might say, you know, I meditate at least an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, most days. They look at me like I'm insane, right? It's like, are you 2 hours? Are you? If I said I watch 2 hours of TV every day, they'd say, oh, what do you watch? You know? It's like, oh, well, that's perfectly normal, right? You know, Netflix, Comcast, what are you watching, you know? Once you learn how to get to that place, you realize that, you know, most people don't get to that place ever. You know, and life without that, I think, is infinitely harder than life with it. You know, it takes a little discipline to get up in the morning and do zazen. It took a little discipline to come here this morning. You could have stayed at home and listened to NPR and then gone online and read the Daily Kos or Politico, and you could have gone, and maybe you'd be doing your civic duty by being so unhappy. But actually, you did something much more important by coming here today and calming down on the cushion and beginning to enter samadhi. You will be much more helpful to others as you go through the day and as you go through your week because you've done this. You know, sometimes people with family responsibilities will say to me, I feel really guilty coming to sit. And I feel, you know, actually, you know, in Chinese Buddhism, they say that if somebody in your family becomes a monk or a nun, it's a benefit to the family for 7 generations. And I believe that's probably true, right? I mean, it definitely helps if somebody in the house can get to this place. You know, I think you can be a better father or a better mother if you are not operating from a place of constant emotional distress. If you can ground yourself in the moment, you can be more loving and generous, more creative in your responses. So yes, you have to take a little time out. You have to close the door on your kids, maybe, and on your husband or your wife, right? But when you come out, you're likely to be a much better partner to your spouse, much better parent, if you're not driven by your own compulsions and fears, right? It's a little bit of time out from our daily lives in order to be much better in our daily lives, right? But there's another dimension to this too. Some of these sutra books, we have various kinds of sutra books, as you've noticed, and they've been assembled at different times by different people. Some of them have this beautiful calligraphy on them. And some of them don't. And some of them have at the back let me read it to you, because it's very important. It says, let me, this is a Zen teacher, let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes, and the opportunity is quickly lost. Each of us should strive to awaken. Take heed, do not squander your life. You know, I think that's really important, you know. You know, the Buddha says that at the end of your life, when you look back at your life, it's like that. You realize that human life is, you know, there are these little flies, the summer flies, they live for a day and they die, right? And we look at those flies, or you hear about those flies on the Nature Channel, and you think, wow, thank God I'm not one of those flies, you know. But actually, you know, our life is like a day. You know, when you look back at it, it's like that. You know, now that I've passed the 6-0, you know, I look back at my life and it's like that. The other day I came home and my wife was watching a movie, Galaxy Quest or something, and And I said, oh, wow, you know, that movie must be 10 years old. And she said, Kurt, that movie is 25 years old. It's like, what? You know? Or I hear things on the radio and I think, oh, yeah, Crosby, Stills, Nash. You realize, oh, my God, that's 45 years old, right? It's like, can that be? It's not really 40 years old, right? You know, life is like that. You know, we go through our lives without really encountering who we are. The Zen view is that Buddha nature is at the core of your mind. The core of your mind is enlightened mind, you know. And this is from a certain standpoint, from my view, is that finding this enlightened mind, you know, it's called the Dharmakaya sometimes in Buddhist thinking, a Buddha nature. In Chinese Buddhism, this is called standing face to face with the source, seeing the source. You know, this is so important. You know, it's so important. We say in Japanese Buddhism, it's Daikensho, Great Awakening. You know, who are we really? You know, my name is Kurt. I was born in, 55. I live in New Jersey, you know, but that's not who I really am. You know, who I really am is my true nature, Dharmakaya. You know, and, finding this, you know, when the people have this experience, you know, they encounter this, we say Daikensho, and it's the most astonishing experience in the world. And to realize, oh my gosh, that's what I really am. You know, that's what I really am. You know, that's what the Zen master in that quotation is talking about. You know, I shudder to think, as we're lying on our deathbed, we say, oh yeah, I remember all the TV shows I watched, right? That seems like a sad way to go, right? You know, and yet people spend, much of their waking time sitting in front of a television. You know, hopefully when people die, they say, you know, I'm so glad to have known my mother and my father. I'm so glad to have known my brother. I have had so many friends. I've helped so many people. And that's much better than, as you're dying, thinking of all the TV shows you used to watch, you know. From the Zen standpoint, you know, that it's wonderful to have those cherished memories, but it's still not understanding who you really are. You know, still not being fully awake. And so, you know, this goal of being fully awake is really what Zen is all about. So it's a shame to live our life without encountering who we really are. You know, it's a shame, because everybody can do it. You know, the Buddha was very specific. He said, everybody can awaken. You know, he was actually asked, you know, are there some people who are just hopeless? And he said, no. You know, there's nobody who can't awaken. He didn't say when it would happen. But if you apply yourself consistently, you know, it can happen. You know, one of the major figures in the history of our school of Zen, is a person named Asanga, an Indian monk named Asanga. And Asanga was one of the founders of the Yogacara. Zen is really, if you want to get technical about it, is really Yogacara Buddhism. And the Tibetan version of Zen, one version of the Tibetan version of Zen is called Mahamudra. Mahamudra. Both Mahamudra and Zen are the children of the Yogacara school. So we're like cousins or brothers even. Very similar in our outlook. Also, Dzogchen. These were all like one family. One group went to Tibet, and the other group went into China. But a Sangha was one of the founders of our tradition. He was the one who discovered, you could say, how the mind really works. You know, early Buddhists believed that there were moments of awareness, like this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment. But they didn't know how those moments persisted as a self. They couldn't figure that out. You know, so a Sangha was the one who said, you know, you have an unconscious mind. Your mind is not just consciousness, it's an unconscious mind. But there's a story about a Sangha that goes like this, you know. A Sangha was a very brilliant scholar of Buddhism, but his achievement did not match his intellectual development. So he realized, you know, all of my knowledge is really theoretical. I need to practice on the cushion. And so he decided he was going to leave everything and go live in a cave for 3 years and do zazen until he had daikensho. He thought that when he had daikensho, he would... his word for Dharmakaya, you could say, was Maitreya. He was going to be face to face with Maitreya, who sometimes called the Buddha of the future, of the next Buddha. So he went for 3 years. He lived in a cave, and at the end of 3 years, he said, "You know, I haven't had daikensho. That's it. I've given it 3 years. I'm at it. I'm out of here." So he left his cave, and he was going back to his native place, and he saw this man with a metal rod in his hand, and he was rubbing it. This is a story, so this probably didn't really happen, but it's illustrating a point. So a Sangha came across this guy who's got a metal rod in his hand, and he's rubbing it back and forth, you know, with his palms. And a Sangha said, "What are you doing?" And the guy said, "I'm trying to wear down this iron rod. I'm turning it into a needle so I can sew with it." And a Sangha thought, "Okay, well, look, that takes a lot of patience. And he's just trying to make a needle so he can show his shirt. So I'll go back and do another 3 years of meditation." So a Sangha goes back and he does 3 more years of meditation, right? And he comes out and he has another experience like that, right? He sees, as he's walking home, he comes across a waterfall. And he sees this, the little drips of water have made this enormous hole in the stone. And he says, "Okay, look, you know, that little drip of water over a long time has actually dissolved all of this granite, this very hard stone. I'll go back for another 3 years, you see." So he went back for another, his third 3 year session, right? And then at the end of 3 years, he said, I still haven't had daikensho. You know, I'm out of here." So now he's walking. He's walking home, and there's a dog with an injured leg. And a Sangha is so moved by the dog that which is lying down in distress, that he pulls the maggots off of its injured leg, and binds the dog's wounds. And then he looks over at the maggots, and he begins to feel sorry for the maggots. And so this is a story, don't do this at home. But he cuts out a piece of his own flesh from his leg and puts the maggots on it very lovingly. And then when he looks up, he has daikensho. He sees Maitreya face to face. You know, so this is a myth, right? But it's saying, you know, it's not easy to wake up. But, you know, in the process of pursuing enlightenment, he became a truly compassionate person, right? And he says to Maitreya, why didn't, you know, I've been waiting for you for 9 years. Why did it take so long? And Maitreya says, you weren't compassionate enough to see me yet. Now you are. You know, you even have loving kindness for those maggots. You know. So, basically, from the Zen standpoint, it's a great pity to go to your death not having encountered who you really are, because you were caught up in things which are much less important. You know? So as you're nearing the end of your life, you could think of all the Huffington Post articles you read and all the morning edition radio programs you listened to. And you can say, oh, if only I had had Daikensho, but unfortunately I was reading the Huffington Post. So please, you know, try to turn off the Huffington Post and turn off the radio sometimes and sit. It's a great pity not to do that. You know, this story has another dimension, right? Another dimension. You know, Ganto had been through this terrible civil war. All these people had died. And, you know, it was possible for Ganto to really be depressed, right? He was able to be helpful to people, because he was able to get to this place, in spite of all this suffering, where he had real joy. Real joy. You see, that Ganto's laughter comes out of all this suffering. And you could say, how dare he laugh when people are suffering, but don't you see that suffering people want to be delivered from their suffering? You know, that laugh is the laugh of their liberation. That's where people who are suffering want to be, in happiness. Yes. So there's one more dimension to this story. You know, Ganto himself was murdered. You probably didn't know that. But Ganto was a great Zen master. He survived this whole civil war. And one night he was alone in the temple and a burglar broke in. And stabbed him. And he let out this huge, he called mu. Right. So Ganto's shout is famous in Zen practice. 700 years later. Was it 700? I think it wait a minute. No, it would have been 500 years later. 500 years later. After Ganto's shout, there was a Japanese monk named Hakuin. Hakuin. He was just a young monk. But when he read this story about Ganto's shout, he was deeply, deeply bothered. He said, how could a deeply enlightened monk at the end of his life shout like that? He thought it must have been a shout of fear, you know, like help. And Hakuin was so bothered by the thought that this great Zen master at the end showed himself not to really be deeply awake that he couldn't put it down. It became his koan. And in fact, working with this koan, Ganto's shout, Hakuin had his Daikensho. And he said, now I understand Ganto's shout. So, what did he understand? He had seen his true nature face to face. Ganto asked a monk, where are you from? The monk said, I come from the Western capital. Ganto said, after the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword? The monk said, yes, I have got it. Ganto stretched out his neck before the monk and let forth a great yell. The monk said, your head has fallen. Ganto laughed loudly. Later, the monk visited Seppo, who said, where are you from? The monk said, from Ganto. Seppo said, what did he say? The monk recounted the story. Seppo gave him 30 blows and drove him out. So sometimes in Zen, when the teacher gives you 30 blows with a teaching stick, he's trying to help you. Secho's verse. Since the rebel was suppressed, the sacred sword has been restored. See, the sacred sword is your joy. See. Why the laughter? The master knows. Too small a reward, 30 blows. One gains, one loses.